Hey, everybody. This is FinOps Fridays, our podcast hosted by Aptio and IBM, where we just try to talk FinOps. We try to get industry experts to share their wisdom, advice, experience, and also have a good time. Video stream live on LinkedIn, post to YouTube, and the audio is a little bit longer, and you can find that wherever you listen to podcasts. For more information, head over to Aptio.com. But for now, let's dive right into the podcast. Thanks for listening. Welcome to FinOps Fridays. My name is Hunter Willis. We have Jonathan Thorpe and Andrew Midgley, also known as Midge, on the line with us today. What I want to do is start with a quick introduction. So, Johnny, you can tell us a little bit about yourself and who you are, and then Midge will go over to you, and then we'll get this conversation started. Thanks for joining us today. Let's dive right into it. John, tell us who you are, what you do, and thanks for joining us today.
And thanks. So I'm Jonathan Thorpe. I've been working in the cloud and with FinOps things for almost a decade. At a large enterprise security company, and then for a provider of call center software. And now I'm doing some consulting work, still in the FinOps space. So had a good time, and I've known Midge for, is it 6-7 years now?
That's right. I know you guys have. Yeah, sorry, Midge. Yeah, I know you guys have worked together for a really long time. It's fun having you both on here. Midge just like came back from having a glass of water, and I jumped right into this. Midge, go ahead and introduce yourself. Sorry, man. Go ahead.
Yeah, no worries. So my journey, it probably has a similar length to Jonathan. So for me, I got involved in cloud cost management in 2013. At that time, I was working for a large Australian media company called realestate.com.au. Anyone from this region will know them. And yeah, it was one of those situations where controlling costs was really difficult, and there were very few patterns to follow. And we created some good patterns, we created some bad patterns back in the day. It was fantastic. After a couple of years of working in that role, I joined Cloudability. So that's 2015. And ever since 2015, I've actually been working on Cloudability itself. So a range of roles, predominantly in the product space, product marketing, product strategy. So very passionate about the space. I'm very happy to have both you here, and of course, Jonathan, especially. So, yes.
And you've both participated in the community and been active. And, you know, one of the things that one of the reasons I'm really excited to have you both on this call is that you both worked in-house and as kind of like consultants in this space, right, in this world, and seeing things from, you know, both from that perspective of like being that FinOps person inside the org and also helping out organizations from the outside as an advisor. So I want to start with Jonathan, and we've talked about some of the different instances where you've helped organizations stand up FinOps practices within their organization, kind of get it rolling, and also kind of starting where they might be still in that walk phase and most of the areas of FinOps that they're working in. And also, before I let him talk, I do want to mention, you know, Midge has done the same thing. While every role he's had, while he's been here, he has advised and worked with so many different customers and helped them implement FinOps, oftentimes from start to finish over, you know, a long period of time through different engagements and instances there. And in some cases, even working with Jonathan to make that happen. So, John, talk to me about what it's like to try to stand up FinOps in an organization from that beginning. I know that you've got some experience doing it where they're kind of like, they've already kind of started on the engineering side, or maybe like that chargeback showback, both from that perspective where chargeback showback already exists, right? So both sides of that kind of fence. Can you talk about the challenges of having to kind of do it all at once when you're standing up FinOps and kind of getting that buy-in for the practice within the organization?
Okay. So, bit of context there. You know, I was always sort of at it from the engineering perspective. So, you know, we actually had a platform engineering group, which I was part of. And so essentially, you know, centralized, we managed the cloud platform, and then product teams actually used the managed environment that we had. And also some teams had their own accounts and so on. But it quickly became apparent, especially once you start running down your migration credits, that you want to start using money more effectively. So the platform group that I was in, we established a cost and efficiency forum, you know, which run every couple of weeks. But, you know, as they talk about, you know, this is way before the FinOps Foundation, but, you know, the core concept of we weren't, even though there was a shared cloud platform, we were not going to just dictate to everybody. So, you know, the actual central, well, the bi-weekly meeting that we had both members of the platform engineering team and from each product team, an architect, and also somebody in management. And in this meeting, we were basically able to discuss upcoming initiatives, you know, which map to KPIs, and, you know, begin to circulate ideas from a central platform team. You know, everybody put their ideas together and then figure out how we would actually move towards executing on them and measuring them. Because that was essentially, you know, how we started before even any tooling was really, you know, in place.
Right. And what did the structure around that look like? Like, how did you go from, hey, we've got ideas, to like, hey, this is what the engineers need to be doing, and then how are we going to communicate that back out to the rest of the organization?
Well, essentially, there was the members of the bi-weekly meeting that were the key to that, because as I said, we had somebody from engineering leadership from each product team and the architect from each product team in the meeting. So once we'd actually had our forum and we began to agree on more or less on what needed to be done, then they would be able to take that information back to their teams and have the discussions about how it was going to be achieved. And then primarily then I would work with the engineering leadership and the actual architects, because I had a relationship with them from being a solution architect helping migrate them to the cloud, you know, to actually work out, well, okay, this can't be done, this can be done, you know, and handle communications of it. So, for example, you know, RIs weren't always as flexible as they were, and we had goals for if we want to get, say, 70% RI coverage in this region, well, this region's new, maybe 50%. And then you talk to the actual product teams, right? And they're like, well, you know, we think maybe we don't want to commit because, you know, maybe we can re-architect and begin to horizontally scale. It's like, well, when do you do that? Oh, we think it's going to take 6 months. I'm like, okay, I know the resources. I know what's going on. That, tell you what, that's not going to be 6 months. But tell you what, we got this awesome thing that we do. We can get your break-even points. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to get you to commit based on the break-even points. So you say it's going to take, say, 6 months. You know, let's say you say 4 months. I'm just going to say 8. But your break-even point is 3 or 4 months. So what I'm going to do here, being in this engineering role, but also working with finances, when somebody tells you, hey, you've got this unused capacity, because remember, these weren't convertible RIs, I'm going to go there and I'm actually going to defend you to finance and show that these were the break-even points, but already saving money. And that's the sort of thing where you begin to build that technical relationship and really buy the teams. You get that balance, right? You optimize the cost how you can while still helping the teams work towards a greater goal of re-architecting to save even more money in the longer term.
And Midge, can you jump in here and talk a little bit about kind of like the thought process and analysis that goes in towards setting a goal? Like, hey, you know, where does that come? Like, we want to set 70% commitment goal for, you know, the resources that we have. How are we going to analyze that, work towards it? How are you building kind of the metrics out to meet that goal, right? From a practical standpoint, and also from a process standpoint for the organization, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Let's talk about that. Actually, one thing I will come back to in a moment, because I feel like you touched on an interesting point earlier, Hunter. You were asking about chargeback and cost allocation. So I'd like to actually come back to that in a moment. I think that's so critical in the early stages of setting up your teams. But let's come back to that. I'll answer your question about the commitment stuff. So, you know, I think there's always been like this conversation about whether commitment management, so reserved instances, savings plans, committed use discounts, depends on which cloud provider you are with. So there's a question mark of, is that a centralized managed thing, or is that something that you can just send out to the teams and get them to do it? And, you know, there's been flame wars had over this conversation. Really, at the end of the day, everyone has agreed that it is absolutely a centralized thing. So there needs to be conversations like Jonathan was kind of describing, but at the end of the day, there needs to be someone in your cloud center of excellence or a FinOps person who is going to own that and live that. And so you can never be sure of the future, but you know, if they're looking at this problem every day, if they have goals, maybe it's 80% coverage, you know, maybe they have a certain goal of utilization, that can be something that they're looking at every day, and making adjustments as needed. So, okay, maybe at the moment I'm at 80% coverage and our usage over the next few weeks and few months increases. So overall, my coverage is of by commitments is reducing. I'm keeping an eye on that and I can make adjustments. I can keep talking to my teams. But at the end of the day, all of the usage of the organization is consolidated and it is up to that central person to stay on top of it and make the right decisions.
Okay,
mistakes will happen, of course.
Before we pivot to talking about chargeback showback, though, you know what I'm going to ask next, guys, for both of you. Can you talk a little bit about, now that we're having this kind of more in-depth commitments conversation, can we talk a little bit about how that's changed over time? Differentiate for me. You mentioned convertible RRIs. Just for our audience, can you explain what that is a little bit? And then also, you know, was this a multi-cloud environment? Were you dealing with like AWS, GCP, Azure? And what's like, how was it? You know, because the commitment programs aren't exactly the same. They're more for similar for like AWS and Azure, but GCP is, you know, somewhat different than the rest, right? Can you kind of walk us through that and what that looked like too?
Yeah, well, I will touch on something that Mitch actually said though about, you know, the RI purchasing. We did actually review this monthly. You know, we would actually monitor the commitment levels and we would adapt. You know, we would adapt every month. So there were some large purchases that were made and we did. You know, we stayed nimble, right? I mean, we're increasing in cloud usage quite dramatically. So yeah, it's key to actually, this isn't a one-time thing. Buy your RIs for like 3 years and okay, we're going to revisit in 3 years. That's, I mean, don't get me wrong, that would be wonderful if everything was that easy. But you know, I mean, you've asked how it's changed. And I think, you know, as Midge also knows, I think with AWS in particular, the actual pivot to having convertible RIs was kind of huge. You know, it gave people a lot more confidence in making longer commitments. It wasn't so much at that point about, well, we don't want to commit to anything. The conversation then pivoted, for me at least, into, well, which regions are we going to commit to? You know, we think we're deploying this region, but hey, there's a chance we may not. So, you know, it's all about trying to figure out the best balance and what you can convert things to, what you could use, you know, if you had a change of plans. I know that's changed a lot over time with savings plans and things that, you know, Mitch knows a lot more about, you know, because that sort of was a relatively new thing for AWS once I sort of already pivoted to the Azure environment.
Yeah, and the way I'd frame it, Jonathan, is we've gone from a world where the general arc has been from these instruments that were very rigid, that once you purchased them, you were kind of stuck with them. So it might be so specific that it's just for M5 Largers, Windows operating system, and US East 1. You know, it's like literally that rigid. You could do nothing with it. And over time, flexibility has been added in these step by step by step. So to the point now where what we could say is we've gone from what was originally a resource-based commitment to a spend-based commitment. So spend-based commitments are savings plans for AWS and Azure and flexible CUDs for GCP, where in like inherently that flexibility is just there. So you're not committing, like if we think about AWS, and I'm pretty sure GCP is the same, you know, Azure is the same, but you know, if we just think about AWS for a moment. When you're committing to a compute savings plan, you're not even committing to a region. It can float amongst regions. It can go from US East 1 to US East 2 to AP Southeast 1 to so on and so forth. So that's got that flexibility there. You're not committing to a family. So it can go to M5s and go to 6.5s. You're not committing to an operating system. It can be Windows, it can be Linux, it can be RHEL. So you're basically just committing to compute spend. That's spend-based commitment. So it's just got easier and easier and easier. So yeah, basically the cloud providers have said they're going to build the flexibility into the instrument and you kind of don't have to worry about that. So yeah, it's got easier and better over time.
So okay, Mitch, so one thing that's interesting that I would ask you, as you're sort of next one, this is, you know, with RIs, you know that I've been through this before. You know, when AWS would magically just go, hey, I'm going to reallocate the RIs to another instance. You know, and I've had things where, you know, engineers have come like, oh, what happened to my spend? You know, I didn't do anything wrong. I didn't change anything, I promise. It's like, calm down. I know you didn't, you know. And that's, that's when having tools that can actually map all of this stuff and take care of it is useful. But how does that change when you have savings plans, you know, which isn't mapped, as you said, it's mapped to general sort of usage and not region specific. It has a lot more flexibility. So how has that sort
That's
of
right.
conversation changed?
You know, in some ways it has changed, in some ways it actually hasn't. You know, the biggest impact I would say in that context is that with savings plans, you actually don't know what discount you're actually going to get, what benefit you're going to get, because they move around between instance types and regions where the discount percentage actually changes. So you actually don't know exactly what you're going to get when you buy them. But in terms of the actual nature of the problem that you described, the fact that if I've got some resources, I don't know from 1 hour to the next whether I might get the discount or whether I might not get the discount because they do move around. The nature of that really hasn't changed. That is still true and still the case. And so there's multiple ways of trying to solve that. You know, the most simple way that we see solve that is that you would use up like a list cost. So there is, you know, tools like Cloudability and I guess other tools in the market. They'll produce a metric that says, let's remove all of the impacts from any kinds of discounting, including negotiated discounts. And let's just have a pure public cost so that we have that reliability of cost. That's probably the simplest way of dealing with it. But there are other options as well.
Yeah, and that was an approach we preferred to take. Sorry, Hunter.
Yeah, no, you're fine. You're fine. It's good.
We did that as well, Mitch, because we wanted to see really, and you just want to see what impact their changes are having, right? They have no control of the different financial levers like rate optimization and RI purchases. So giving them sort of some raw, it was almost like the cost itself wasn't so important. It was the trend.
The trend, that's right.
Right. So the
I've
engineers, they
heard.
want to see the trend. We've been told to do
Yeah.
this. Okay, this is going up or down.
That's right. I've even had like customers talk to me and say, can you give me a measurement in apples or c cans of beer or something like that? You know, it's like, can you give me something that's not even dollars? You know, something that's sort of just, it's just a number, you know. That's actually never happened to my knowledge. But yeah, the cost list approach is kind of good enough.
Before we move on, I want to ask you guys, I want to kind of bring it out to people that are still in that crawl phase. So we've been talking about these concepts, and this is a really great exploratory conversation. What's your advice to, I know that like I've talked to some people recently, some organizations right now, that they're getting ready to get started with their commitment program, and they've got some goals, and they know the savings is out there, but they are terrified of commitment, right? Let's say it that way. They're afraid to press the button, right? Without a ton of data and without knowing everything that's going to happen, without fully, because it takes a long time to really understand the depths and details of, you know, signing up and then, you know, getting going with the commitments program. What's your advice to an organization that is just now kind of getting rolling with their commitment program?
Mitch, I'll let you take first pass at that, and I can jump in.
Yeah, I mean, to me, there's always been like one obvious approach that seems to be universally accepted. So I guess I'll talk to that. And that is just to do something. It's like, okay, let's say, you know, you're in the new world, you're in this new world, and it's savings plans. So, you know, the first thing I would do is like just ignore. Generally speaking, you can have some special needs for reserved instances. There can be some special needs, but if you're just getting started, just start with compute savings plans for AWS. Just start with flexible cards for GCP. For Azure, it can be a little bit more complicated. But anyway, so let's presume I'm AWS again. Start with compute savings plans. Maybe I'm spending on average, you know, on compute, $100 an hour. Perhaps that's what's happening right now. So maybe start with a commitment of $10 an hour, just for the first month. You know, well, that's only going to be 10% coverage, but let's just get started. After the first month, you start seeing these savings are real. You can measure them day to day, even hour to hour potentially. And you can just see that exactly what we're saving day to day through the month.
Savings is
Now when it comes to the
savings.
second, savings are savings. And now when it gets to the second month and you go, okay, well, our coverage is still about 10%, we've still got 90% we can cover, it's kind of real. You know, the confidence starts building and you can just kind of work from there. That's kind of the approach that I see.
Yeah, and I think part of it as well is just an honest conversation with people that are nervous about, you know, you can poke things a little bit. It was like, well, do you really think we're going to, you don't want to commit for 1 year? Well, do you think we're going to change cloud providers in 1 year? That's not really going to happen. And, you know, do you think that your product doesn't have a future? For the year, it's like, as soon as you give people the real, it's like, oh no, we're definitely going to be here for a year. We're definitely going to be using this cloud. Oh, and you're, wow, this is really low hanging fruit for saving money. It's like, well, you could either do optimization, utilization and stuff, and that's hard work, or you can buy some RIs, which honestly, it's an easy decision at that point. I think part of it is also the education, right? About, we've in the background, we've committed to using this, so we're not going to move clouds. Your product isn't going away. Just give them that comfort where they're going to say, okay, we'll commit to something. And, they know that the commitment's already been made in other ways. So they're going to be in this environment for that length of time. And they're not going to be wasting money. It's so low risk. And I think as well, that also comes mid for where, break-even points are, right? Yeah. Even if you did nothing else, if you're going to break even with whatever you do in a period of 5 months, then just people can make peace with that.
That's right. So let's... And even a three-year commitment, often you'll break even after about 1.5 years, So, and if you're talking about compute, like it's so general that, Do you expect that you're still going to be using compute in 1.5 years' time in that cloud from that cloud vendor? There's a good chance you are, right? So yeah, and as soon as you go past that break-even point, I think this is the point you're making, is like you're already ahead. So even if you as a company decided that cloud was no good and you're going to go do something completely different that's not even cloud, you're still ahead at that point. So it doesn't matter that you've still got time left to burn. That's what you're saying, I believe.
Yeah. Yeah.
So let's pivot and start talking back towards kind of moving a little bit out of the engineering side, still in the engineering a little bit, but looking towards kind of that operations conversation and then moving towards that like chargeback and showback. Midge, what were you dying to tell us earlier about chargeback, showback that you clearly had a light bulb come on and you wanted to dive into that in the context of that engineering conversation?
Yeah. I mean, just like I'm really using this is really from my own memories of being in a team where we had to deal with this rather than, obviously I've seen customers do this, but my memories are much stronger. So of doing it myself. And I just remember it being so critical early on to come up with what we called like a top level allocation. So I don't know how many teams you were dealing with, Jonathan, you can probably walk through that in a moment, but I think we maybe had like 6 or 7 teams. And in those early days, the most important thing we could do was clarify which team was using which resources. How are we going to organize that at the top level? So as long as we knew that that was team A was doing this, team B was doing this, team C was doing this, that was a very solid foundation. And the reporting that we needed to do beyond that would come.
You could at least ask people who to approach so about why it was there.
Exactly. And then there's a whole conversation around tags and accounts and, how are we going to do that? What is this top level allocation, which will become a chargeback? How does that going to work? And for me, that was like the most important thing that we did in the early days. And so I just going to put out to Jonathan to see like how you went about that. Like, was that who was responsible for making those decisions? What approach did you actually take in the end? Like, did you structure it by accounts or what? Like, what was the way you did that?
Okay. So, I mean, the actual tagging standard was part of this, cost and efficiency forum, or, which was sort of more or less of a subset of a cloud center of excellence. And, which I think if you remember at the time, we actually used shared accounts. So that we shared, we did not have every single product had its own account. We had a couple of big, large shared accounts that were managed by a central team. And therefore, being able to know who was using what was critical. So, we had the tagging standard, and I think the key with that is right. You keep your tagging standard, basically as it's only as complex as it needs to be, right? You start the granularity that you actually want to report on, and it does get more complex when you have shared accounts instead of like a straight delineation of, hey, product. I think I worked with like 12 or 13 product teams. Would have been so easy if it was just like, hey, product team one has account one, product team two has account two, and then your allocation is essentially just maybe breaking it down by project or component within each account. But then when you have that as part of a shared account, then it becomes even more critical that you've got your tagging really nailed down and everything, you know, tagged as much as you can. And to that point, you know, we had the tagging standard that was there. But then we also had tooling in the background, which was auditing, you know, auditing the dev environment to actually make sure that we're also auditing prod, but we had a bit of a heavy hand with dev, basically, which was, hey, you've deployed something. It's not properly tagged. So in dev, we're going to give you a warning and you got 2 days to fix this. And then, okay, it's another day gone. We're going to now email you and copy in the VP of your business line. And then next it's going to be like, okay, we told you so. So now this is being shut down. So there had to be some, there definitely had to be some a stick at times to get people to really pay attention to it. I mean, we'd never do that in production, of course. I mean, I've heard horror stories of people that have accidentally turned that on in places and production stuff has disappeared. you know, and it's what we also did around this was gamification. So
yes,
leaderboards,
yes, yes.
Tagging coverage.
Excellent.
You know, and also with every KPI as well. So, hey, guess what? We've got this tagging standard. Hey, Mr. VP. So we actually had stuff that was able to look at who deployed and link that to the VP of their business unit. So that will go on. Then it get competitive, right? Nobody wants to see, I'm behind this VP or whatever. It's like, that suddenly gets the from, hey, we're sort of persuading our engineers, whatever, by spinning down things to like, oh, hold on a second. We don't want to be at the bottom of this list.
That's great. Like with gamification, there's so many things, small things that you can do to incentivize organizations too, because like with things like pizza parties and little rewards and prizes and shout outs, like those things aren't substitutes for, you know, financial incentives and like raises and goals for, you know, KPIs and all that kind of stuff. But they're great for, hey, you know, whichever department or whichever team on the cloud operations team, you know, has the highest percentage of correct tags gets pizza or something, you know, like those kinds of small incentives for actual rewards for gamification, even though the visibility itself sometimes is enough. But in some organizations, you need to add a little bit more grease, almost literally, right, to the game. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would. What I would say, this goes back to the chargeback and showback stuff, because if you're going to be doing gamification like that, you've got to make sure your cost allocation is accurate.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, you don't want to be attaching to somebody's name and have wrong, incorrect data.
I was going to ask you a question more generally about gamification for both of you, I guess. What do you see is the most effective strategy with gamification? Because obviously, in gamification, there's people that are towards the top and there's people towards the bottom, or teams at the top and bottom. Do you find the carrot or stick to be the most best motivator? Is it like people are, you know, it's like, oh my god, I'm the top team, and that really motivates people, or is it, oh crap, I don't want to be the bottom team?
I think as for individuals, right, they were the people that are doing the work, getting the recognition of the savings made, right?
Yeah.
So it's kind of both, right? So if you're an individual being asked to do the work, then just acknowledgement, you know, is a good thing, sort of. But I guess as you sort of move further up the stack, sometimes it's the oh, I don't want to be towards the bottom. But I mean, I found that doing this FinOps stuff, you know, there was recognition. There was recognition for me, and there was recognition from others. And it was really, you know, appreciated, because if you're, let's face it, I mean, whatever you're doing to play with cost, you know, it's especially back before FinOps took off, right? And it was more of a recognized practice. It wasn't something that had big recognition really about, you know, it was just like, hey, you're beginning to go over budget, or you could do, fix it. That was never something that people really, you know, got a lot of recognition for, right? It was just like, we avoid consequences. But it pivoted to kind of like there's positive recognition. You know, it became not as stressful really.
Yeah, from my perspective, like, I've been in management in different industries, and I've also worked with a lot of different kinds of orgs in different parts of my career that I've been in, but almost all of it has dealt with a lot of change management. And the classic IT answer to almost everything is like, it depends, right? So much of it depends on the culture, because you would think that like recognition and positive incentive would work for everybody, but like in federal public sector, for instance, they get mandates all the time that they have to follow, and speed's not like an issue for them. So for them, they're just like, we just tell them they have to, and it's a mandate and they have to do it, or they get, you know, reprimanded. Like, it's just how their job is, right? So they get to just be like, this is the requirement, you must do this before anything happens. But like, even on the commercial space and in places where things are more dynamic, the most effective thing ideally is to find out and do a little bit of research to ask people or team leaders, like, what would motivate them, right? Like, is it a culture where, you know, there's too much stick and some carrot might really make a difference? Because I've seen that happen. I've seen organizations where they have like a fun game and it immediately starts to change the culture of the whole company because everybody's been demoralized. And now with this one project or deployment, right, or, you know, trying to get people to accomplish this goal, there's been some fun injected to things and nobody knew that this could happen. And the whole culture of the organization starts to change because of a little bit of fun. But in other places, it's like they get all these little incentives and it kind of just is white noise and nobody really cares. So you kind of have to start doing a little bit of a combo or even leaning more towards the stick to actually try to get people to do stuff. And so, you know, it depends so much on the culture of not even just the organization, but each individual team that you're working with, and sometimes down to the individuals themselves. Because some, you know, the classic, sometimes when I talk about this, people are like, well, engineers don't want to do anything social. They're not going to be motivated by a pizza party or going to a bar or something like that. But that's not always the case, right? But sometimes it is. So thinking of getting a little creative about it, it's a big deal. I've seen people that don't care about recognition. They just want to work towards like a half day off as a reward. They'd much rather have that than anybody caring about what they've done. It just, people are so different. But at the base of it, how much more do you feel like your boss cares if somebody comes up to you and says, hey, what would motivate you to help us out with this change management and this implementation that we're dealing with? What extra little thing could we do to help you want to do this work? Like, that changes the way people think about who they're working for when you ask a question like that. Because how often do we get asked that question, right? Does that make sense?
And keep in mind, right, we had that cost and efficiency forum, right, which was all of the teams represented, you know, all of the products. So we didn't decide on the reward sort of, you know, whatever the gamification was in a vacuum, right? It wasn't like somebody said, hey, finance, how are we going to do this, right? So there was discussion really about that. Sure. But what I would say is I've never met an engineer that's going to turn down an Amazon gift card.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
How about you, Mitch?
I'm actually remembering some pretty fun times back in my last job. I was talking about before, where I came up with a system where I judged every team. It was an automated system I came up with that was called Midge's Law. I named it after myself, and it was based on five. It was shocking. I mean, it was based on five attributes.
Awesome.
I'm not sure if people respected it or not. To be honest, I mean, the fact I called it Midge's Law was probably my first mistake. But it was so long ago, I can't remember if it made a difference. To be honest, but but it was everyone was judged. You know, you can see which teams are doing well.
Right.
Teams are doing badly.
Right.
But I don't know, from a personal perspective, I would not want to be near the bottom. That's probably what would motivate me more. It's like, I don't mind being in the middle. I don't want to be on the bottom.
I think more recently, from what I've seen anecdotally, just that visibility and shining light on it, creating competition within teams, almost works by itself without needing much of a reward. Just being able to be like, look, these teams are optimizing better. These teams have a higher rate of proper tagging when we do any kind of audit that we have, or these teams, however much it can be tracked or following the processes that we have out there, and just have a leaderboard of like, these are the ones that are doing well, these are the ones that aren't, because everybody wants to be in the green.
And I think so much of it has to do with like providing context and visibility. Like that's what this is doing, a lot of the gamification is doing. Like I remember talking to engineers within Cloudability, I won't give any names, where, you know, there were major projects, and I'd be like, do you have a thought about how much this is going to cost in COGS for our own cloud spend? And the engineer is like, I don't really care. It's like, I'm like, we're working on Cloudability, man. We've got to care about what we're spending on cloud. And, you know, but it's about getting the context for them, you know, getting the visibility for them is kind of the key.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think part of this is the FinOps Foundation, right? This is more of a well-known thing now. You know, it's not like we're going to give you an incentive to do this. It's a known sort of practice that's actually, you know, filters down at all levels. So I think that has been, you know, very important in, you know, getting people to actually be willing to jump in and recognize the value of it.
And that's, I'm going to take a second to pitch it, right? Like, go to finops.org, check it out. They do have, for almost every single thing that they tell you to do as part of the FinOps framework, there are measurable KPIs that you can use as goals. One of the last conferences I went to, I was sitting at a table with a bunch of people that were all, each of them individually had leadership roles within their cloud program. And I was talking about this very conversation about incentivizing their employees to do the work. And they were like, well, they already have bonuses, right? As even as engineers to do it. And I asked them point blank, I said, are the FinOps implementation benchmarks that you guys have in their KPIs to meet that bonus and to like, as part of their job or whatever? And they all said no. They hadn't actually related it to real rubber hits the road.
And as I say, Hunter, I'm sure a phrase that you love is, you can't measure it, you can't manage it, right? It's as simple as that. That's a bit of a cliche.
If those guys are listening, it was a great conversation. Really, I learned a lot, but you know, that was a big takeaway for me. Sorry, go ahead, Mitch.
I think the ultimate KPI, the ultimate measurement in our world is that unit economics one.
Yeah.
You're talking about the rubber hitting the road. That is where the rubber hits the road. And the best example we have from our team to Cloudability is us processing cloud billing data on behalf of our customers. And so our ultimate metric was, how much was it costing us to process 1 billion lines of cost data? That was our metric. What is that costing us? And, you know, because we knew the amount of billing lines that we were processing was going up. So was every chance that our overall cost would go up, but could we measure efficiency by cost per line we processed? And that made a huge difference for our team. And we were able to become about 80% more efficient from memory by doing that.
And like Netflix, when COVID hit, their cost per user went down. It was costing them 25%. So it went down by 75% cost per user as they scaled up. And the words I've used to describe this is it growth or is it bloat, right? And the only way to measure if you're scaling properly, like as it grows, is your cost per whatever, click per day, cost per user, cost per billion lines of billing data, right? Is that going down as you grow? And that's the awesome part of cloud, right? That scalability, that ability to get that growth from that unit cost metric.
Yeah.
When you can extract it. What's the word I'm looking for? Scalability is a good word, I guess. John, go ahead. Yeah.
And I think one of the important things is, right now that you mentioned unit economics, I mean, your tagging and other cost allocation methods have to be spot on and granular, because ideally you want to be able to feed in your unit economics and to help drive engineering decisions, right? Because maybe you've got some big system on the background that's to do with billing, for example. It's not the latest, greatest. You're not going to completely rewrite it. People don't want to touch it because it's considered legacy. But your unit economics are pointing to like, wow, if we actually redirect some engineering resources to this, we could become so much more effective.
And economies of scale.
Exactly.
Economies of scale was the Midge is like pinging that in there. Like, yeah, that's it. That's what I was looking for.
Yeah.
Well, and another side of this too, right? Because not every single application and workload that you have in the cloud is generating a profit or tied to something that's profitable necessarily. And again, working with U.S. public sector, like they don't say savings, they say cost reduction, right?
Yep.
And one of the ways they can prove that they're doing well is by demonstrating cost reduction through unit economics, by saying like, hey, every user we support with this workload is costing us less per user now after we did X, Y, and Z. And for them, their budget's set. They get like an allocated budget for the year. And as long as they stay within that budget, they're fine. So if they can save, they get to do more with that budget, but they're not necessarily incentivized. They're incentivized to be super transparent. So allocation's like a really big deal for them, right? but they're not necessarily super incentivized to do everything they can to save money all over the place, but they can do more if they can save, right? They can do the passion projects and innovation and things like that.
That's one of the core Finox Foundation principles, right? It's not about saving money. It's about you. For every dollar you spend, you're getting maximum value out of it.
That's right.
Exactly.
All right, guys. Well, this has been a fantastic conversation. I think we got into the weeds and bounced around in a couple of different places, but I think it was like really great exploration, both from commitment side as well as chargeback, showback, and how organizations can operate and motivate their employees to, you know, optimize costs and also meet policies to implement taxonomies for chargeback and showback, right, to operate functionally as an organization. And then we just had this great conversation about economies of scale and unit economics. So thank you all both for being here on this. Midge.
I said every good FinOps conversation should end with unit economics. You know, every podcast you do, Hunter, should end with unit economics, then you've been successful, right?
that's right. John, did you have anything you wanted to say before we pop off here?
No, I've done that. FinOps has been a great journey, and I've been fortunate enough to, you know, partner with Mitch through most of it. So it's been good. Great talking with both of you.
All right. And Midge, one last word of advice or anything you want to say before we sign off?
Oh, man, I can't think of one good piece of advice. Maybe the piece of advice is don't listen to me. Listen to Jonathan. He's my advice.
All right. Well, everybody, do catch Midge's session at FinOpsX 2024. He is going to be speaking there. And if you're watching this past 2024, after FinOpsX 2024, you can go back, try to catch that recording after the fact, too. And I really appreciate both of you all on the call today. So thanks for joining us, everybody. Take care. Have a good one. And we'll see you next time.
All right. Thanks.
Bye.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening to this episode of FinOps Fridays. If you have any FinOps questions or questions about the podcast, reach out to us at FinOpsFridays@aptio.com. You can also find more information at the website there as well. We're also really active on social media. So hope that you like, subscribe to our content. And if you have any questions, you can also comment there. Hope to see you next time. Hope you have a good one until then.